You've got the bib shorts down around your knees.
Yeah.
Like sort of restricted movement, waddling along. Is that the point when the wild dogs came out? Right.
Riding, ridden, best tales. I've never been ridden.
Exactly. So, don't ride over your own tail.
Yeah. Whatever don't touch my tail with a pencil on.
Hello and welcome to the Velocino podcast.
Yeah, you forgot your name.
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
It's Nick.
Hello, and welcome to the Velocino podcast, where the best stories have not yet been written. This week, we are welcoming back our local hometown hero, Nick Icarus Clark, from returning from the incredible Atlas Mountain Race. In one of our previous episodes, Neil's got to talk to him before he set off on the race. So if you haven't heard that, stop now, go listen to that episode. And here we are with Mr. Clark.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, almost completely healed, still pretty fatigued, can't feel my feet, and my rib still hurts up here, but other than that, I'm pretty heavily fatigued as well. But.
And how long has it been now since you've been back?
Oh, so since I've been back or since the race finished?
Since the race finished.
So the race finished on what, 21st, 22nd, something like that?
Yeah, so it's about 10 days, is it, something like that?
Yeah, so yeah, probably about
10 days, and there's still can't quite feel the feet.
I reckon I'll probably still have levels of fatigue for a couple of months.
I can highly recommend Birkenstock for your feet.
But in terms of feet, so from the 24 hour...
You just ignore me.
Yeah, I did. For the 24 hour, I lost sensation of my feet for about a month there or thereabouts.
Right.
And same for that record attempt. So I kind of expected it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of... But it's just annoying as hell because it feels like... You know when you've got cold feet, they're like blocks of ice?
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of just feels like that. The whole time, and you're like, oh, I just need to warm these up, and then you remember actually warming them up will make no difference whatsoever.
You just got to wait for the nerves to get back
working again.
But they didn't die, right? The nerves, they will come back.
I don't know.
Oh,
yeah. Oh. Price you pay for an awesome race.
Yeah, that's true.
And talking of an awesome race, I've been lucky enough to pop down to the local bike shop where your bike is unwashed, like it's just come finished the race and is up on the window display at Lavello Cycles in Berkhamsted, if anyone wants to go and have a look.
Yeah, the Celestial. Yeah, it's awesome.
And that bike looks like it's been ridden for years. That bike looks like it's...
One long bike ride, one careful owner, buy it now.
So there are bits missing off it. It's covered. It looks like it's taken a massive pounding. And this has all come from just the one race as well.
Yeah, poor bike handling and a bad rider pretty much has wrecked the finish on that bike. Yeah, I refuse to wash that bike because it just looks much better that way. So yeah. I gave it back to him as I last used it. There you go. You can have it back. I haven't even lubed the chain. So.
It looks, I have to say.
The chain, if you move the chain, it's got like this much movement. It's like that. Yeah, it's definitely really efficient.
So we've now got you here. You're still recovering. Your bike is still recovering, if you like. So I guess in a really short question, how was it?
Hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, Nelson, who organised the race, absolutely fantastic. And the organisation and the volunteers were unbelievable. And it was quite a family affair. So Nelson's mum and dad were there, like helping run sign-ons and checkpoints. And his mum was having goes at locals that were trying to rip off like racers and trying to get all involved. His dad was helping put bikes in bike boxes and do check-in. And so for me, for like coming from like time trialing, where a similar sort of atmosphere, I could relate to loads of that. It was great. And then seeing all the volunteers, so there was a pregnant lady doing all the checkpoint and there's photographers and media people all giving up their time and effort and cost and just to allow someone like me to have the fun of that race. It, absolutely fantastic. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And Nelson did a fantastic job. And it like I said, it's totally different to anything I've ever done. And absolute hats off to those people that's their thing and they do it because it's seriously, seriously hard. Mentally, you have to be nails.
Yeah.
Just to complete one of those things. And to do that as your chosen discipline of cycling, for want of a better word, you're one sort of tough cookie. I mean, there's absolutely no two ways about it. I mean,
So, I mean, just to remind people who perhaps haven't listened to previous podcasts, I mean, you are a champion in 24-hour time trial. You've done world record attempts. You are more than just the average sort of Joe.
Still just a punter, to be fair.
Yeah. You quite graciously say, yeah, I'm just a punter, just like you guys. But he's more of a punter, unlike me and you, Niels. But
you're a punter, I'm a punther.
I wondered where you were going with that. But
not a cool guy.
No.
Anyways.
So, Nick, so I mean, you've got loads of experience doing these things. So it must have been right at the beginning. It must have been like that mix of, okay, I'm doing something I've never done before, but at the same time, bits of it are feeling quite familiar, like, you know, within the setup and getting yourselves there and getting set up. But what was it like the moment, like, the gun went or the person dropped the flag?
Stupid.
What was it like?
Silly,
what happened?
Daft. Did the thing that you should never do, which is go off too hard. I mean, I remember chatting away to some lad, his name Jamie 4 hour, and we're gonna be doing this for a few days. I don't think this is sustainable. And he turns around and goes, no, I don't think it is, but it's fun, isn't it? Yeah, maybe I'm gonna ease off a little bit now.
So this was your so this is like from the off.
Yeah, like,
you actually, it's brilliant. Your advice from our podcast was the mistake everyone makes, right, to be successful. Don't go off too hard.
Yeah, it's the three golden rules of time trialing, as Mike Broadbiff says, is don't go off too hard, don't go off too hard, and don't go off too hard. Yeah, so I won the neutralized section, I reckon. No, I didn't. Someone else did that. But no, it's one of those things. You get excited, don't you? And because it's even with a 24 hour, when you start a 24 hour, and I said this before, is you think, do you know what? This is so easy. I could do this all day long, and you can't because you need to actually rein it in a bit more. And Steve Abraham, who is famous for doing the attempting the year round time trial where you ride your bike every day for a year and see how many miles. Really experienced bloke, does all axes and this kind of stuff as well. He rides for Arctic Tax as well, or Arctic Aircon. And he was like, if you think you're going too slow, you're probably going about right. And I did not think I was going too slow. So
was it just you on your own out the front? Or
no. Like, so there's like sort of basically, as I said on that night before sort of chat, and I was sort of nervously sitting there, and you got no idea. And I was hopelessly non-competitive by halfway because I'd made so many errors and I wasn't in the mix remotely. And I just wanted to try and finish as quickly as possible because I wanted to enjoy still racing it, but I was no longer racing for a position. I was just trying to see personally how quick I could do it. So I was racing myself at that point rather than other people. But prior to that point, you can't draft, but you kind of, because it started as a mass start, you're consciously aware that that's Jay Petiveri over there, who's renowned for doing well at these sort of things. He's one to watch. And there's the winner, Sophie, and then James Hayden was shrewd enough to be somewhere at the back. But then you've got that, and then you've got Christian Meyer, who you know is pretty handy, and see, like, right, I kind of need to stay with these people, there or thereabouts, or at least pace myself equivalent to them, because ultimately, if I want to be in the mix, then, which is the wrong attitude to have, because it all, come 2 days, 3 days down the line, it is all relatively irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. But again, that comes from experience. And so you're there, and then it's only as you're getting to the summit of the first big climb of the day that the person next to you goes, oh yeah, Jay Petiveri's quite good at downhilling. Whoomp, as he goes down, like it's a downhill race. He's like Danny Hart on that world championship race. And you're like, oh yeah, I'll just do the same. Whoomp, and then immediately go over the bars and you slide across the floor and you've hit rocks and you're like, yeah, I'm going to struggle to keep this bike in one piece at this rate, never mind and myself.
Obviously it's the kind of race where everyone... falls off at some point. How long did it take before you were
on my own doing my own thing? Yeah. So it's a really cool affair because, okay, drafting's not allowed, so you can't sit on someone's wheel for the whole race. But there's an element of riding with people for a bit, and then naturally, one of you might need to stop for something, or you get your head down, or you're better at climbing than they are, and so you drift apart. But you end up with these weird sort of 10 minutes, maybe half hour, maybe even an hour, there or thereabouts with someone, and so. Whilst you were on your own for the whole race, you never felt like you were alone.
Yeah.
And there was this weird, and I think that's very much because it's a prescribed route rather than things like the TCR, which are you pick your own route. So it's quite nice and slightly comforting, and you know that you'd probably come across someone eventually, or someone would come across you.
So in the back of your head as well, for some of the more hairier bits, it's that sort of safety blanket. But it meant that you had these really weird relationships with people that might have only last 10 minutes, but have a really big impact. So there was a chap from Zimbabwe, and I feel really bad that I can't remember his name off the top of my head, something like Woolen Camp. Really nice chap, right near the end, and I'm in bits. I'm trying to, and I remember seeing him on a descent, it wasn't tarmac, but it was hard packed gravel. So I was riding it like a road bike, and I'm throwing it down. I come past him, and I'm like carving around it, and I'm really enjoying the descent because I can do it quite well. It's one of the things that I'm quite, and then it hits the uphill, and I'm standing up because I can't sit down, and he comes crawling back up. And then we end up chatting for 10, 15 minutes about everything and nothing. And it was just really nice. And he was a really nice bloke. And you're sort of listening to him, and he's done loads of this stuff before, and he's not the youngest spring chicken, and he ended up beating me and did a really creditable performance. And then later on, again, a similar one, a bloke called John White, who's a mountain biker, absolutely hard as nails, bumped into him and a bloke called Alex, who's he's American. If he's not and he's Canadian, I'm going to be really upset. I think he's American. And Alex, right when I was at the point where I had these really bad saddle sores, declared that he'd basically not sat down for 400K, which transpired to then be 600K. And I was like, well, I've only got 200K left to do. If he stood up for 400K, I best man up and get on with it then. So if I hadn't have met him, I might not have finished.
Yeah, do you know what? It's if someone says, can you stand up and ride your bike for 200K? You sit there and go, I'm not really sure. No, particularly over that kind of
terrain. Yeah, and it's 200K, says, slow going. 200K is a day. 200K, that's like 20 hours of standing up on that terrain.
That's just incredible. So in terms of, mate, there's just so many things to ask you about it. So that first day, you go off like a slightly too quick. There's a big bunch, but it must have been great fun. Oh, you got this massive climb.
The police were amazing. So the Moroccan police, they basically did a neutralized section, and it was full on neutralized police cars out front, motorcycle outriders, way more than I think even the organizer expected. And they were brilliant. And you found them at significant, I think they were quite concerned about potential risk to their long-term tourism industry if something happened to us. So I think there was an element of that. They wanted to make sure it was a safe race from that point of view, security-wise. And I don't blame them. I can totally see why they want to do that, because they want to encourage that. And that it's a really good place to go for tourism. And it's certainly, if you want to go mountain biking or road cycling, because the roads, when you're on them, the tarmac is absolutely brilliant.
Ah, right.
Really good tarmac when there's tarmac. When there's not tarmac, it's really good off-road riding. I've lost my train of thought now. But yeah, so the neutralized section was really good.
And then from what you were saying before we started, you're saying it then went into this 800...
8,000. I think it's about 8,000 feet worth of climbing.
8,000 feet of climbing.
To the snow line.
Down the other side. And as the race progressed, I mean, you're very good at riding a bike.
Not off-road. I am not very good off-road. Well, I learned that. I basically went on a 5.5 day off-road intensive cycling course. I now am a rock garden king compared to how I was when I left.
And now, so of all the different things that started to, you know, as things come up, because I know you were thinking, right, because you know, what kind of kit do I need to take? Like you were saying, you know, you're taking everything because you've not got the experience to work out what do you drop. And I was just thinking, what were the kind of things that got in the way? Was it like, was the kit okay? Was the bike okay? Was it the off-road? Was it the climbing? What were the kind of things that started to build up?
So I think it's really interesting, because when you look at all the people that were riding all the different kinds of bike, I think you could make almost every bike, I say almost, you couldn't do it on a road bike, but like gravel bike to full sus mountain bike, you could make all of them do it. Yeah. How well they did it would depend a lot on the rider. I think from 90% of the people riding that is a monster cross gravel bike like I was on, or a hardtail mountain bike, front sus only. It was the way forward for that. I mean, if I was doing it again, if I didn't have the Celestial to do it on, I'd do it on just a hardtail mountain bike with 2.25-inch 29ers.
Would you have to think with a normal mountain bike that you would run out of handlebar positions?
So yes, but I found that on the drop bars that...
Sorry, what? Is that handlebar positions?
Yeah, that's right. Again? That's spot on, right? Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. But with the flat bars, you would have more control for the technical sections. So I think if you were very good off-road, you'd benefit more from the drop handlebars.
That
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't necessarily need to have, you could probably get away with it. Whereas for me, for example, I managed to, I think, go in on every short, small amount of water that there possibly was. I managed to somehow end up in it. For the, some of the river crossings, to use the term river, it's more like puddle crossings.
Yeah.
I think I managed to stack it in every single one. And the only one that would significantly be referred to as a river, I managed to go in so much that I couldn't unclip in time. And in the style of a comedy moment, just completely fell off sideways, ended up in the water, unable to get off from under my bike. And I think that's what caused a saddle sore. So I ended up with wet shorts. I took quite a bit of advice on kit and stuff. And one of them was, you only need one pair of shorts for a race that distance. I can see why people say that. But if I was doing it again, I'd take two pairs of shorts purely because in that situation, I could have changed them out. Or as I'd started to get saddle sores, I could put a second pair on top. I think that would have made a hell of a lot of difference. Whereas by having one pair of shorts, I made a poor choice. I think what I should have done then is, even though it was earlier than I would have liked to have got my head down, I should have got my head down for a couple of hours with the shorts inside my sleeping bag, try and dry them off. But instead, I rode with wet shorts. That started chafing. And then because of the nature of the race, there is no opportunity for you to rest that. And so it was a downward spiral from that point on. And that's about when I stopped racing and started trying to just survive, because it was getting just unmanageable. I mean, I ran out of dressings, I ended up just gorilla taping my saddle sores directly on just to try and stop them from rubbing against stuff, which then caused its own problems in itself.
I find that fascinating when you look at these sorts of really big events and that kind of stuff, in the multi-day things. It's not often, this is one of the reasons asking the question, it's rarely like some major things goes wrong and
you have saddle sores that bad. That's pretty major, trust me. That's what most people were scratching for. So
Chris and Mayer retired from the
race. Like, until you've been there. Yeah. I mean, you tolerate it for a while, which is probably what most people have had saddle sores wise.
Yeah.
I think for those people that do a lot of this stuff, they'll probably be able to testify that they can be so much worse than the ones I had. Yeah. But like, I end up with my saddle, I could physically see the plasma and blood on the saddle through the shorts by the time I was finished the race. And like, I was in bits.
You should have brought some pseudo cream. It's good for nappy rush.
Oh yeah, I heard they had that all over the Moroccan
desert.
So. I could barely get hold of paracetamol. Never mind that sun cream was impossible to get hold of, because you can only really get that in pharmacies. And I'd lost mine when a zip went on my bag, and so I ended up with sunburn so bad that I think one of the competitors is a surgeon and the other one's a doctor, Charlie. And they looked at my ankles and they're all swollen up, and it wasn't from like overuse of my like ligaments or tendons, it was from the fluid from my skin cells in effect leaking down to the bottom of my feet. The burns were that bad.
Yuck.
Yeah, it's like full Chernobyl by the time I was finished.
So for those of you who are eating whilst listening to the podcast, there's an interesting thought. Actually, Nick is now going to tuck into another slice of pizza. So when I was saying about the idea that it's just that the small things that go wrong, I wasn't belittling the impact of saddle sores, don't get me wrong. But it's things like, you know, everything, you know, if you hadn't got wet, you might have lasted a little bit longer without the saddle sores. And it's, you know, you see these sorts of things build up.
But that's, I think, where the people that do this all the time don't make those mistakes. And I learned so much from it. Like, before this race, if you'd told me, oh, I've bust a spoke, but like, oh, you best get that fixed. And by that race, I'd got like five spokes taped to the next spoke on, and the bike was still rolling. So like, I wouldn't necessarily massively stress about things like that anymore. And so other things, like I decided not to take a Camelback. I would do the reverse this time around. I lost bidons left, right and center over sides of mountains, bouncing out bottle cages. And yeah, and you learn that from, and then when you're talking to other people, I lost all my bottle cages. You look and suddenly they've all got them bungeed on, or they've got like extra strapping because they've been there, done that and learned from it. And you're like, oh yeah.
Makes sense.
Makes
sense now. Yeah. I see why you did that. Yeah. Excellent.
Or they've got Camelbacks, or they've got something in their frame bag. And then you see people that have got various different things. I mean, like, I think I wrecked my zip on my frame bag because I didn't really recognize that how much the sand was destroying the zip. And I should have, like, washed it off before I tried to use it. But then most people's zips went on all the different brands of frame bag because of the grit. So I think some designs just can't cope with that level of abuse in that environment.
Yeah, in that particular environment. Yeah. Oh, fascinating.
Sorry, but when you say Camelback, how often do you have a chance to refill it?
About once a day, twice a day.
Oh, wow. So you have to...
So that's the other thing that I didn't really take into account. So it's all well and good on paper, saying, oh, there's only 20, 30K to the next resupply, which is great. 20, 30K for a start, it takes a lot longer than when on a road bike. I've realised this now. Yeah, you don't bang that out in an hour. you're not even on tick over. That it doesn't take into account the time of day you're hitting those resupplies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I never really considered that in my thought process. So you might have 100K for the longest resupply on paper. So you've got that in your head. And so you hit the one before it and you get yourself fully stocked up, get to the next one and get fully stocked up. But then you've got four more that might be like 25K apart. But actually, it's one in the morning. So then you've got another 100K before you get to somewhere that's actually open.
Right.
Because you're doing it all at night.
Yeah.
And so there was an element of that. So some people, depending on when they hit things, were in a completely different environment to other people. Mm. So like there were sections that I never saw in the daytime. So the Colonial Road, I did the whole thing at night. So I didn't see any of it. And it sounds like it was really awesome. But my mental perception and my memory of the sections where the road had collapsed, I say road, I use that term loosely, from my perception of it. When I seen the pictures of it in the daytime, it still looks pretty impressive, but it doesn't look anywhere near as daunting as it did when I saw it. In my mind, it was like I was standing over some sort of cliff edge to certain doom, you know, like so out of some sort of, you know, like, I don't know, Lord of the Rings, where they chucked the sort of ring into the...
How did your lights last out, actually? Because I know that was something you were concerned about.
And do you remember I talked about that sort of drain where you're not charging as much? So for most of the race, that wasn't a problem, and it was sustainable. The problem came with the saddle sores. When the saddle sores got so bad, I mean, and there were some further implications, when, for example, again, it's that the same chap from the Zimbabwean chap. We end up in a spot of bother, which I'll talk about in a separate story. As I got slower, because the terrain got harder and I was unable to maintain speeds, and I was doing a lot more hiker bike, because standing up, I just couldn't ride some of the technical stuff that was uphill. It was just, my calves were just in tatters. So it was like a lot more, I probably walked at least a marathon. Well, in that, during the course of that event, because I just couldn't ride it, that meant that everything was taking longer. And because it's taking longer, I'm still using the same rate of water, particularly in the middle of the day when it's like 32 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And so I'm smashing through water, but I'm not reaching those resupply points as quickly.
Yeah,
yet.
Yeah.
So you're getting that sort of, those sort of compounded issues. So much so that when one of the second from last climbs, I realised there's like 20 odd K to go to the next, 15, 20K to go to the next resupply point. Which again, on paper, doesn't seem that bad. But when you've just walked the last four and you've up this mountain, you're like, do you know what? It's middle of the day and this is bad. You've run out of water now. This is not good. Yeah. When do I stop thinking rationally and need to make a grown-up decision that I can no longer do this because I'm actually putting myself at significant risk and might need to actually scratch because I'm not safe? And I got to the top of this mountain, having been passed by this Zimbabwean chap. And there's this madras, like religious school, on its own, not on the map, didn't know it was there. And normally they all come out and they're waving and they're cheering, and like, because it's an unusual thing. And they, so as I come out, they like brought me in, sat me down, and he was in a similar boat, and they were basically resupplying us because they just saw that we were just in bits.
Oh.
And they fed me, and you're not allowed to go asking for help, but if they offer it, it's different. And yeah, it was just a totally different outlook to, say, busy London streets and like that, because I think they recognise they're in quite an inhospitable part of their own country, and that bad things happen if you get things wrong. And I think they recognise that you need a bit of help. So topped up all my water for me, fed me honey and bread and Moroccan tea, and gave me an apple, which was the best. I don't particularly like eating just raw apples. It's not my sort of thing. Absolutely demolished it, and they were lovely and chatted away to us, and then off he went, and then I went shortly afterwards. But absolutely fantastic, and they didn't need to, they just chose to. And it was, and allowed me to continue. So it's absolutely fantastic.
The thing is as well, is it happened for you at just that was obviously a great act of kindness on their part. But for your part, I mean, that was that probably saved your race, I can imagine. Because, I mean, without that, you'd have been starting to think to yourself, how am I going to get to that next day?
Yeah, interesting. But, I mean, prior to that point, earlier on, I was getting a little bit down. I mean, not immediately prior to that point, but earlier on when I realised I was not really racing, I was just trying to finish. And I was like almost willing for a mechanical or a reason to be able to have a reason why I could tell everyone at home why I didn't finish. Like it just got a little bit hard and I thought, you know, I'd rather watch Netflix. And so I was like proper tears. Is that before or after I got naked? I'm not sure. But either way, that's a whole... And I was really, really down.
Naked is good.
And I was riding down this hill and had this big off, like must have been tired because I hit this rock so hard. I sort of went sort of semi over the bars. Bikes that went sliding across, grabbed hold of it in style of an action movie, and the bottles kept going and they went over the side.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, and it, like literally wanted to cry a little bit inside. Yeah. Might have shed a little tear, thrown some expletives about, picked the bike up and realised that I'd done a spoke. I thought I'd just done the one. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not letting this put in. And whereas I've been looking for that excuse, suddenly when it'd been presented, I was like, no, I'm not having that. Descended down on this like knackered spoke, got to the bottom and it hit a road. And at the time I'd also run out of money as well. Like I realized I needed to get cash out and there's no cash machines anywhere. Yeah. And I didn't know the state of the wheel and didn't have any issue. I'd got no water now. And you're allowed to leave the route if you rejoin the route. Mm-hmm. And by pure chance, there was a taxi coming past for doing the mosque run in the morning. It was just as first light. So I phoned up the organizer to listen, I need to leave the route to get cash, try and sort my wheel out and sort my life out, and then I'll get back on it. Is that okay? Because these races are new to me. I don't know quite whether or not you need to tell them or whatever. So I full on like, breathe. And he said, that's fine. Just as long as you return to the start point where you left.
Yeah.
That's not a problem. So it went off. As I was looking at the wheel, I realised that I could just get off and tape it on, so rather than actually fix it. So that was one less thing to worry about. Got cash money out, so I didn't have to worry about the fact that I was dangerously low on funds to even buy water and stuff. And then used that opportunity on the way back to just smash loads of food down my throat. And off I went, and it changed my mindset. And that was the tipping point, I think, where I stopped at all trying to race and just try to finish. So I think prior to that point, I'd sort of resigned myself to the fact that I was no longer competitive and in the mix, but I was still kind of flogging a dead horse. And then I was like, do you know what? Just finish this race for yourself as quickly as you can for yourself. And then almost straight after that, I met John White and Alex, which is the bloke that was doing the bazillion miles standing up.
Yeah.
And it just changed everything. It turned out it was five spokes, not one.
Five spokes, you'd done.
Yeah. not one.
Absolutely incredible.
And just coming back, you said just before you got to this place, you were naked.
Right, yeah, so, because the saddle sores were really bad.
Naked is always good.
Yeah, I thought I need to air them.
Right.
And then I realised, like, I was going to air them just in the sleeping bag, like when I went to sleep for a couple hours.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, that's not a lot of time in the grand scale of riding versus...
And it's also covered by your sleeping bag as well, isn't it? At that point,
and you're on it because you're sort of laying on your back. And so I'm sort of bit of hike, a bike, bit of riding, but because it's dark, because I can't really see what I'm doing, because I'm feeling sorry for myself, I'm doing a lot less riding than I perhaps would do. And it gets to the point where it starts to drag up, and I'm not cycling uphill this. Right, I've got an hour or two left to go before I get my head down. I'm just going to walk this unless it goes downhill. Or like flat.
Yeah.
May as well air myself. So I got myself. So my bib shorts are like round my knees. And then I'd like put my top back on. And so what I was doing is I was walking along with like my bits all hanging out, strolling along, flashing everyone if they could see me at this like 6,000 feet up or wherever it was in the middle of the night, pushing my bike. giggling away to myself about how hilarious this is in these like tiny little steps, because I've not completely taken my bib shorts off, because every now and again I can ride it again. So I then have to pull my bib shorts up and then put them like the straps over the top of my outside. And which is a skill I learned from Anna Henderson, because she's
putting on her pens while she's riding.
No, she wears her bib shorts in the winter on the outside. So then she puts her gilet or her long sleeve like so that she can anyway, it looks silly. I mock her heavily for it. And there I was doing it. I was like, Hendo style. So it'd be like bib shorts down by my knees, walk for a bit, then I can ride this bit, pull them back up. So, and I just thought it was hilarious. And I thought it'd be even funnier, because what you'd find on doing the whole of this at nighttime, randomly you'd suddenly see this like tiny little green flash of someone's GPS tracker on their bike as they're like parked up asleep in. Is that you could just imagine that someone had decided now was the time they were going to wake up and get themselves to get going, and they'd just come face to face with what they thought was a very strange encounter.
A sort of half waddling naked man.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
It didn't happen.
The next time on Whiteleaf.
But yeah, so so I reckon I'm the only person to cross the Atlas Mountains in a semi straight of undress. Yeah.
I like that. I like that. I can just imagine as well. Is that the point where you've got the. You've got the bib shorts.
Right,
you've got the bib shorts down round your knees.
Yeah,
like sort of restricted movement, waddling along. Is that the point when the wild dogs came out and you had to start picking up the pace?
Luckily not. Otherwise, that would have really, really, really focused the mind. But there was the relentless fear of. I think I got chased like five times.
Five times.
Once with someone else, which was quite good because they became the sacrificial lamb. So as I managed to win the dog sprint, leave them to fend for themselves. You can die by dog. I'm escaping.
Yeah, I don't have to outrun the dogs. I just have to outrun you.
Yeah.
Excellent. So genuinely, wild dogs that are chasing you. I don't know what the Moroccan wild dog looks like. I mean,
they're just feral dogs. Feral is probably the best way to put it.
Okay, it's not like
It's not like some sort of like wildcat, but dog equivalent, or like some sort of jackal. No, they're just feral dogs. There's quite a lot of them, and they sort of group up and. Yeah. Chase you. But there was discussion at the end of the race of whether or not they actually would have made contact, or if they were just trying to like psych you out. But I wasn't prepared to find out.
Well, I googled it actually. They would eat you.
Okay, yeah, good. So I made the right call.
Yeah. But we're not quite sure what type of dogs they were. So are they kind of
massive? They were twice the size of you.
So they were.
Have you seen a brown bear?
Yes.
Twice that size.
Am I right in saying this is because if the story was, it's about the size of a pug, it's not going to be quite as impressive.
To be fair, most of the time I couldn't tell you how big they were because they were just these green glowing eyes as I glanced back to the sound of, just don't stop until the dog stop barking. And there was a couple of like sort of semi-Mexican standoffs where I genuinely was like filled with fear. I remember carrying it towards one sort of village and I could see the green eyes in the distance, and every now and then I was like, don't notice me. Like, just cycle really smoothly.
Don't
try not to get the free hub to make a noise.
When you suddenly with closed eyes, because if you don't see them, they don't see you.
Do you remember when you were a kid and like when you used to walk along, you used to hear the footsteps of your own footsteps and think someone's following you, look around, you can't see them. So you then get faster and faster, and before you know it, you're running full pelt home. Yeah. It was a bit like that with the dog eyes.
Just imagine you going, don't let the dog see me. I'm nothing here. It's just a man walking along with his pants round his ankles. No, there's nothing to see.
Brings a new term to mean dogging, doesn't it?
Next time you have to bring a little sock for these occasions.
Yeah.
So just that you're not completely butt naked.
Yeah.
What, Chili Peppers style, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. That would be...
I can sponsor this, actually. I'll give you a village sock.
The Villagino sock. Good. But yeah, so there was the ever fear of dogs. But I mean, it's really sad actually, because when we got to the finish, there's quite a few sort of pretty unwell dogs there, and some that had been sort of semi adopted by the volunteers and stuff. So they've got quite a bit of a problem there. And I think there's quite a few sort of animal welfare charities out there that are trying to sort it out and sterilize them. I mean, it's not an issue we have here, so it's quite different.
And did you meet from your previous conversation? You've obviously met. What was it? Is it Daisy the chicken?
Nancy
the chicken. Sorry, of course, Daisy the chicken. Nancy the chicken, who obviously
came to demise.
came to demise. Did you come across any other chickens?
No, but I ate an awful lot of omelets. There's an awful lot of eggs I ate. No, but I had a standoff, Mexican standoff, a genuine Mexican standoff with a camel.
With a camel?
Yeah, right near the end.
I'm
genuinely pleased that I took the decisions I made, as I heard that someone else actually came awry with a camel and got like a bit of a boot from a camel. So I've seen camels before from having been down that neck of the woods. Haven't seen wild ones in the sense that I saw them this time around. So I actually saw like a wild herd, which was really cool one morning. But right near the end, there's like the sand, just so much sand. And these weird sort of channels of like sort of banking with like sand in them, and you're sort of working your way through these, almost like there were sort of field dividers, like, like you'd have like irrigation ditches, but they were just filled with sand, cactus either side. And I sort of did a left turn and came face to face with this full size big mama camel with her baby behind it. And I'm thinking, llamas and stuff spit, and I think camels do as well.
Camels do, yeah, definitely.
And I'm really close to this camel, and my God, its feet are massive. It probably would not take kindly to me going too close to its baby, but I need to go that way. And it's really sandy, and I can't be go backwards because that's just like effort, and I'm done going backwards or anywhere other than back to the finish. And I'm so close, it's almost there. We stood there, it looked at me. I looked at it, it made some strange sounds, and then it went on its way. But it was a very, very tense few moments. I was like, I don't want to get hurt by a camel. They're a lot bigger when you're about 4 foot from them than you would anticipate. And when it's not like a fun ride with someone taking you on some sort of little like camel trip, and then you're like, yeah, this isn't going to end well. I will not win this argument. I think someone else got kicked by a camel. Bless them.
Were you thinking as well, I have come this far in this race?
Imagine if you got spat in the face by a camel at the end, you'd be like, done, scratching.
I don't want written on my race sheet, you know, death by camel. I mean, nobody wants that.
No one. No.
It's not a DNF, it's a DBC.
Death by camel. good reason to scratching, though. I couldn't finish because the camel trashed my bike.
Yeah.
You should have just jumped on it, really. Like,
not allowed to. You have to cycle or walk or carry a bike.
What do they know?
The camel's not got a GPS tracker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you could probably say that the organisers would get the hump.
Wait.
Oh, not that one.
No.
Thank you very much.
No.
No, it was this one.
It's that one. There you go.
No, it's not this one.
No, stop pressing buttons. It's not your show.
There you go. This one.
Yeah,
that's better. That is more appropriate. Did you see any other wildlife when you were out there? So it was dogs and camels and...
Tortoises. I saw a couple of tortoises. Yeah, they were going faster than me. lots of... Now, I think they're called Berber squirrels or Moroccan ground squirrels or some kind of... But they look a bit like a chipmunk. They're like stripy squirrels. Loathe them.
During the event, was there anything that really surprised you? I mean, don't get me wrong, face-to-face with camels and all the other bits and bobs that were going on would have been quite surprising. But was there anything that you went, I didn't think I'd be doing this?
Rock climbing at night whilst holding a bike probably is up there. So there was varying degrees of rock climbing.
At the point when you're scaling a rock, do you not think... Am I off route here?
So there was a couple of times where you're like following the trail and like stopped, and I was like, oh, this appears to have run out of path. And it was like this dry wadi that was like a proper drop down. And then I like got my torch out, looked down, I was like, no, that's a straight down drop. And then I looked, that was like, and that's a straight up at the other side. How am I going to get around this? It's like a problem solving task. It's like, okay, no, there's no path near me that I've just missed. And this looks like a straight down. And it's one of those things that at night, it probably was 50 times worse than it actually is in the daytime. But for me, I was like, this is pretty insurmountable. And so I found myself like scaling down and getting to, and then I was like, how am I getting up? And I was like, found myself like full on 3 points of contact, holding my bike and going, well, I kind of now need to go to 2 points of contact because I'm holding my bike. And
This is like bouldering stroke single pitch climbing.
Yeah.
I'll have, if I just bring my bike up and sort of rest it on my knee, I can then put my hand there and then put my hand back down to bring my bike up. Yeah, and that, so that was a little bit. And then far later on the old Colonial Road, I knew that there was some little Garmin blue flags that said road collapsed here or road failed here. But when you forget that in your head, well, you don't forget it, but it's like you're involved in other things, and then you suddenly get to a lack of, and to use the term road is a bit of a stretch when it's nighttime, it just seems a little bit more like a rough path, and there's nothing. You're like, this is new. Take the torch off, and you've got these big boulders, and it's like the whole road has collapsed down. And again, having seen the pictures for the daytime,
yeah,
it didn't appear like that at night. In my head,
yeah,
it was far more significant. And you're putting your feet on these big rocks and some of them are moving, and you're like, this is like a game of Kaplunk, but I'm one of the marbles. This could all go very wrong very quickly. So go down about sort of 15, 20 feet and then back up the same way, and you grab hold of a boulder and it just vanishes. Shit. And when you look at the pictures, you can see there's a really good one of someone pushing their bike up round this collapsed section of road, which obviously at night I kind of completely missed,
yeah,
because I was like, that's the road, it's gone. So it's straight down, straight up,
yeah,
and
yeah.
So I'm like doing this, and I could have gotten like a little bit off piste and stuff to sort of do it, but yeah, it was I was like, this is ridiculous, this is like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, and I'm scrambling with a bike, and like I'm putting the bike, and then I'm like the bike sliding away, and you're like, this is silly. So yeah, but I mean, it was cool, but
bit more surprising. Not
it was some dynamic risk assessing going on. Very, very quick, rapid dynamic risk assessments.
And what was the because obviously is what we've talked about is obviously really tough. We've got the giggling whilst walking naked to be one of the few people to be declothed as you're going over the top of the mountain. But there must have been bits where you were like, this is awesome. This is
all of it. This is absolutely all of it. So right, hardest thing I've done. But most rewarding. I mean, absolutely fantastic. And if you Nelson's other race, the Silk Road Mountain Race, sounds equally as appealing for that kind of level of awesome, particularly when they're so well organized. I hate to use other people's quotes, it sounds a little cheesy, but I think Mike Hall, a legendary bloke for this sort of stuff, says nothing worth doing is ever easy. And I think there's an element of that. I think the more you're invested in any kind of effort, you get out what you put in.
Yeah.
So the more you invest into it, the more effort you put into it, and the harder things appear to be, the more you value the outcome.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So if I roll around that and it was like a easy day out, I don't think it wouldn't cement itself in my mind as such an amazing achievement or amazing event or amazing thing to have done. And I think the things like the sunrises, the sunsets, the views, whilst they're great and everything, it wouldn't necessarily have had the same impact. I think I took about 2 photos, and I think people get really I don't want to take away from all these people that took some really fantastic photos. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant to see some of the photos that I saw post-race from all the people that entered it, but I was just so involved in the event and the race, I just didn't have time to take them.
Yeah.
I was too busy enjoying it and enjoying the views and looking at stuff for myself. Like, why would I want to look through my phone taking the photo when I'm just drinking it in anyway? So like that, I mean, and the culture, I quite like Morocco anyway. I've been there a few times, but post-race, chatting away, where we were staying at the end, sort of chatting away to the hosts that were there, and French and Arabic and stuff like that, and just drinking Moroccan tea, and
lovely.
Yeah.
And you did mention that you got in a little bit of bother with one of the other races. You said the guy from Zimbabwe, did you say?
That's the bit where we got rescued. Well, rescue is the wrong term. Yeah. But when we were coming up, they graciously invited us in.
Sorry, yeah.
And fed us, and it was absolutely fantastic. That sort of culture of just wanting to help. So you're not allowed to go ask for it. But in a country like that, you wouldn't need to, because they would just offer.
When it's such a big impact, like you said, when you're so invested in it and you get so much out of it, is this something where you're thinking to yourself, I could go faster next time. I could do it again with this little bit extra experience. I'd do things differently. I want to have a go at it again. Or is it one of those things where it's a, do you know what? That was the most fantastic adventure. I want another adventure, but probably something different.
So I would 100% want to do one of Nelson's races again. Whether I did the Atlas Mountain race or the Silk Road Mountain race next year would probably depend on the route. So if the Atlas Mountain race was tantamount to the same route, I probably wouldn't do it. Not because that route wasn't great. I mean, that route was fantastic, but because half of the smashing yourself to pieces is to see those sights and those, and if you're seeing them again, I think it'd be quite hard mentally for me to do that, bearing in mind that doing like the National 24 Hour, it's the same course every time. And it just becomes a process rather than an experience in terms of adventure. I think it wouldn't necessarily hold the same adventure. That being said, country's absolutely fantastic. So if it was a different route, say a different start, different finish destination, slightly different, but even if it had sections the same, I'd still want to do it. I'd definitely 100% do it again because I love the country. The race organization was absolute tip top and the concept, everything about it. And I've learned so much. I mean, I was probably quietly a little bit arrogant about it, or quite loudly arrogant about it. I don't think I gave it as much respect as it deserved, even though I thought I was. Yeah. I don't think you can, until you've done it, realise quite how absolutely hard people are that do those races. From the person that came in last to the person that finished first, just, you've got to be really, really, really tough, mentally tough to do those. And I think absolute credit to the people that were doing it, because wherever you came, you have absolutely beasted yourself. You can't just roll round that and finish. So if it was the same, exactly the same, I wouldn't potentially do that. Not because it wasn't great, but because of those reasons. Yeah. But I would definitely do the Silk Road Mountain race instead if I could get a place, because I think I like the sound of that. And from everyone I was speaking to, that's harder. It's longer, it's higher. I don't speak Russian, which I think is the main language spoken over there, or at least it's one of my ones. So I'd have to do a bit of Duolingo. But yeah, I'd do that one. So I think that's probably what I'd do next year.
And so the tips that we've heard so far is, you thought about, okay, what kind of bike? Would you probably go for the same type of bike again, would you? Do you think?
So if I was doing the Atlas Mountain race again, that course again, for most people, I would say do it on a hardtail mountain bike.
Hardtail mountain bike.
Or a Celestial Dark Matter.
Yeah, yeah. Because that bike does look awesome.
It's a mountain bike with drop handlebars, for want of a better word. The Lao Fort was really good. But
that rear suspension they've done on it as well is really really quite clever as well, I think.
Yeah, I'd probably add a Redshift seat post to it, you know, to give it a little bit extra. I wouldn't go full sus, not because I have any experience with that, but because I was talking to other people that were doing the race who sounded like they knew what they were talking about. So I'm going to take their advice, which is they reckon the bearings on a rear sus wouldn't hold up. Yeah. I have absolutely no evidence base for that whatsoever, but I'm just going to say it so I sound like I know what I'm talking about. Ride the Gnar and go full send.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm all about the mountain bikes now.
For the brown pal.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. I'm all about it. I know all about it.
And also, like, I think the reason why Mike is also asking all these questions is when we followed you along your race, like we, all of us, like from here from our crew in Vendover, we had your event on the second screen, so we were following your dots and stuff, and it definitely triggered something in us. Like, we were like, yeah, that's an event that we would potentially like to do because it's new. It's,
I think everyone should. I think it should be compulsory or school leaving. So what I found really interesting, I think you don't need to be athletically fit to do that race.
Okay.
Done. So don't get me wrong.
There was a big sigh of relief from the other side of the room.
Don't get me wrong. I think you need to ride your bike a lot, but it's not so little on that is about how, I mean, don't get me wrong. If you can ride hours and hours at massive power, you're always going to be able to ride faster. But again, talking to John, who's one of the sort of, hopefully he won't mind, he's slightly older than me, but he's far more experienced and, like I said, hard as nails. He was saying he was finding it really interesting that he'd stop for some breakfast in the morning and potentially have someone come flying past him, or just before he'd stop, someone come flying past him, like going like the clappers. He'd eat his breakfast, get on his bike and start riding. And then 2 hours down the road, you'd see them at the side of the road doing something spurious or whatever it was, or sorting themselves out, and then he wouldn't see them again. And it's because he was just plodding along, getting it done, putting big hours in, consistently riding his bike and being super efficient, with competence at riding off-road as well on top of that, because I think he's quite a significantly enthusiastic mountain biker. And the end result of that, he did really well. So I think that there's, it's not necessarily your athletic ability, it's more if you ride your bike a lot, mm-hmm. and you are disciplined, mm-hmm. and efficient and make good use of your time. I mean, James Hayden was saying that he likes to have 20 minutes off the bike, like at the checkpoint, and he said to me, don't, because I was like, I need to get moving. He's like, calm down. He sets like a stopwatch, gives himself a set amount of time. He's disciplined about it. And then he's on his bike, but he uses that time to just decompress, relax, chill out, and then get back on his bike. So I think there's loads of aspects like that it's far less about racing your bike fast and far more about being resilient to things going wrong. So you get a puncture, you have a chain break, you have spokes go on your wheel, you lose your water bottle, that you take them in your stride, and far more about just keep moving, not necessarily about keep moving fast and being disciplined. So I think that anyone can do those races. They're not, you don't sit there and go, well, he really struggled because, and he does all these other races, he does his TTs and stuff. Nah, I think that's relatively irrelevant to the nature of the race. You or I could do that race and you may well be better at it than I am because of the nature of it. There's a chap there, Charlie Holden, who's a doctor from Brighton Way.
Yeah.
Really nice bloke. And he was saying he's not really a cyclist. I mean, he cycles, but he doesn't race. He's clearly very talented, did really very well. But he just obviously quite mentally quite tough and just got on with it and got it done. He's never raced in the UK in bike racing at all. So it's his first bike packing race. He just got on a bike and he's done some like cycle touring-y stuff, but yeah.
It's so cool. Like, as I said earlier, you know, pre-talk, I didn't even know that bike packing as such can be done as a race. Like, maybe I'm blunt, that don't know about it, but I thought this was like really, really cool.
So it's like the original race, so it's not a new concept. You know, that's basically the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. That's how it started.
Did they sleep? No.
No, so the Tour de France was like one big stage initially. Same self-supported principle. In fact, I think the first person to win the Tour de France got disqualified for having help fixing his wheel because someone was operating the bellows in the blacksmiths when he was fixing his wheel. Now, I can't remember if he was the person that won it or came second, but either way, he got penalised because he was getting outside help. That's how the Tour de France actually started. And then over time, he's degraded into the circus that it is now. And I think with the popularity of bikepacking, that's its danger, that it slowly erodes its way. I mean, some of the stuff that you're doing at like dark o'clock at night is just crazy. And when you start to become far more mainstream and people start to get a bit twitchy around insurance and stuff, then perhaps maybe it'll start to ruin itself. But at the moment, I think it's in that golden era.
And do you think you'll, are you tempted to even just this summer, go out for a kind of a 2 day ride, if you like, where you're going to go out, go for a ride somewhere, camp out, wild camp, and
yeah. So I was talking to my coach about it for my race season because now I'm back onto training for my race season. That's park that, move on to the next goal. And I've got some back to back longer rides set up at a certain point in time, and I'm just going to ride to France and back.
Oh, brilliant!
Just because
in one day,
well, not in one day, but. Back to back, so I'll ride for like X amount of time to however far I can get into France from England, and then camp, ride a bit in France, then come back and be back before my wife realizes I've gone.
That's what we are going to do at some point, I think in August or so.
Yep.
Group of us from Wendover, we want to cycling off-road, Wendover to Versailles and back.
Okay.
At some point.
So August, back. In August.
Oh, wait a second.
And back, this is changing now.
Did you say in August?
Yes,
maybe.
Why don't you just change the destination? I heard Kyrgyzstan's good at that time of year. There's this race I know about. A bloke called Nelson runs it.
Yeah, so you really did inspire Niels with what you did, and I got a flurry of messages off him about how inspired he was by it, and I think he's got an order in with our local bike shop for a whole bike packing kit ready to take it on in August for us to head down to France.
It's called cycle touring, and this is a race. That's in my mind.
I also need an e-bike.
So I reckon...
and an e-bike and a massive battery.
I think cycle touring is awesome. And so a friend of mine, Ben Stowe, he rides for Arctic as well. He's particularly quick. He's just coming back from Spain? He decided that he was just going to go cycle touring because he'd done across America with a mate of his. So he's just got on his bike and gone pottering around. I think it's really, really, really... refreshing, because you can get so many places on a bicycle that you can't get in a car. Yeah. You see so much more with the windows in the way, and on foot you are limited in terms of how much ground you can travel, and I just think it's a really good way to experience another country. And I think that if you're ever going to go, when people go backpacking, when they do that gap year, they've got it wrong. They should go bike packing or cycle touring, because they'd see so much more and they'd enjoy it so much more. But, you know, it's not as cool.
It's interesting you say that, actually, because I've just come back from skiing, which is why I couldn't speak to you the night before your race. And I drove up pretty much where I'd been cycling over the summer, same area. And it's exactly as you described, driving from A to B, and in that local area, you see a certain aspect of the roads and things. And then, but cycling in that area, for example, I was sat in the car thinking, oh, we're in a bit of a queue here. But I do know just down there's the fantastic, lovely cafe run by this brilliant old bloke.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if we could get there, that'd be great. And it's just next to the local well. And it's, you just wouldn't know that or have seen that if you hadn't been somewhere on a bike. And that's just one small part of it. There's so many different places.
It's the same with the Atlas Mountain Race. I've travelled around Morocco quite a bit on a motorbike, backpacking, and then doing it on this bike. And I went to places, villages that realistically you would have no reason to go to, and you wouldn't go to any other way. And I mean, vehicles were struggling to get. I mean, the 4x4 support cars, control cars, were struggling to some of the sections. And you're able to get there. It's pretty amazing. So
yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you didn't manage to take many pictures. So while I was following you, or your dots on the screen, I saw all your other competitors, and some of them have really, really cool accounts, which are really worthwhile following. Like was it James Mark Hayden, Jenny Tuff? I think there was a photographer called Nils Lengner as well, who had like amazing photos, and one of his photos is actually one of my most favorite pictures of the event, and it actually has you in it.
Okay.
It's with where you stop and there's a lady.
I'm not stopping, it's just a tight right turn.
Or you're right.
I'm just going that slowly.
And I don't know. Do you remember when this photo was taken?
So I think I do, and I think it was near I think I know the village that it's at, but I don't actually remember anyone there taking the photo, if that makes sense. It's a really weird one.
It's just an iconic photo. Just for you listeners, so there's like Nick riding his bike, and then there's a lady on the right-hand side, and it seems as if there's some kind of conversation going on, which
just
most
it's probably just
isn't.
A smile. It's probably just literally a bit it's really nice that they would visually engage with you or talk to you or want high five. Kids wanted high fives, stuff like that. And they were genuinely excited that you were coming through their town. And it's a big deal. You've got all these bike race coming through. And for me, I'm just like some rando who's riding their bike and completely out of their depth. But for them, that's probably quite a memorable experience, particularly for kids as well, because that's a village that's pretty inhospitable. And suddenly you've got these cars and almost 200 riders cycling through their random village in the middle of nowhere.
The people towards the end of the race, the best in the villages, were like, wow, look, see, we've been riding our bikes sitting down. Look, it looks like all these professionals are riding standing up. And maybe that's the way that we should be doing it. Hey, and look at that one over there. We don't have to wear bib shorts. We can just wear nothing. Look at that.
There's a really good photograph on Instagram of one of the riders who basically said his highlight of his race was two kids on their battered old bikes that are sort of
cobbled together bikes, and they were trying to race him, and they were really like giving it some beans alongside him for a fair amount of time. And he just said it was brilliant because they were just loving riding their bike and like joining in and like riding alongside. And for him, that was a really touching moment. And there's some really good Instagram accounts. I mean, there's Salt Lake Leanne. She's one of the photographers and she took some really good pictures. And yeah, like James managed to, despite absolutely smashing himself to pieces and coming second, still managed to take loads of really good photos. Torsten Frank, who's one of the people who was further back than I was, when he realized he was sort of traveling a little bit slower, took the time to take some really, really good pictures. He got absolutely fantastic one of the night time, and it was one of the most amazing things. I mean, I love the desert for it, where you've got no light pollution, and I'd got my head down on the top of one of the mountains for a couple of hours, and as I sort of lay there just before I went to sleep and closed my eyes, I was literally looking straight up, and it was just, there was so many stars. And it was just quite, it was just so nice because I'm just lying there. There's no sounds, there's no nothing. And it like completely, utterly alone, which is really nice. Mm. And that picture, in fact, I think you've just got it there.
It
just really, really, really captured it. And it was just lovely.
For all your listeners, so if you want to see all these pictures that we're talking about,
hashtag is Atlas
Mountains. We will. Just follow us on Instagram. On the post that goes along this episode, we will add all the accounts that we just mentioned in the description. So you can follow all these people because the pictures are really good and all these people are fantastic athletes.
But yeah, so it's really good. And the community is really good as well because this hat that I've got here was given to me by Tom Albergs. He's one of the riders. He did his first bikepacking race as well. But he'd forgotten an item, so he just messaged on the Facebook group that the race, and has anyone got this item? I was like, well, I brought spare everything. I have one of these. And so like, and he brought, here, this is for you to say thank you. And he's like, you didn't need to do that, just use the thing and just bring it back to me at the end. And there's that camaraderie. So despite the fact you're all competing against each other, you're not, because when you're on the road, you're just like, well, I can't do anything about the fact you're going faster than me. So I've just got to resign myself to the fact that I'm going to chat to you and enjoy your company for a bit and then away you go. So
just as you mentioned, you competed against each other. One thing that wasn't 100% clear to me. So you start all together, right?
Yeah. So
but then you move at the more or less the same speed with like a lot of other people. So how does it work? And then also with like sleeping patterns.
So you're not allowed to draft, but the organizer explains it as company ridings are right. Just don't take the mick, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
So if you come across someone that has stopped and they have just started at the same time as you, I mean, there's a good chance you're actually probably moving faster than them. So it would be very odd if 2 hours down the line, you are still riding alongside them.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something a bit weird there. Yeah. But you have some people that might go to sleep at midnight, some that might ride till 4 a.m, which is why it's quite hard to tell what the actual real positions are.
Yeah.
Because, for example, I was going to sleep quite early compared to a lot of the other competitors.
So did you tell yourself before, I will always sleep at that time?
Yeah. So I know from experience of doing night shifts and things like the 24 hour when I can't help but get tired. So it doesn't matter how wide awake I am on a night shift. I know that at a certain point in time, I will do this whole nodding dog thing for a good 20, 30 minutes. Well, that's not safe in my mind when I'm in the environment I was in. So I made sure that I was asleep before that happened. And then I'd wake up after that and then carry on. So I had a set point in my head where I would sleep. I'd go to sleep beforehand.
And were you able to stick to that? Because one of the things...
shifted a little bit. So if you look there, I pretty much went to bed around about midnight my time, which is, I think, 11 yours-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on when you include the faff. I mean, I was probably only sleeping for 2.5 to 3 hours each time. But there was faff around either side, you know, like sorting kit out and eating and things like that. Because I'd have a hot meal. I'd take like an MRE, which is like a ration that self-heats. So I could eat hot food at night. So I'd bang a hot meal down, do some admin, try and sort my kit out, bits and pieces, check everything was working, plug in stuff into battery packs so that I could charge like my light. Because you got like 11 hours of darkness. So my battery pad light I'd put onto a battery pack whilst I slept just to top it up. Do all stuff like that, which just eats into a little bit of time. But I'd try and get to bed at midnight and have 3 hours off the bike, which sometimes pushed into four. There were times where, because the dynamo wasn't necessarily charging quite as quick, that I'd need to put stuff onto batteries. So I'd come in early, so like 11, 11.30. And then on the last night, it all went a bit out the window. I tried to push on. So I got to the checkpoint three about like 9 in the evening. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd get an hour now whilst I'm here anyway, because I'm stopped riding my bike anyway. So I'll do all the admin I'd normally do, get my head down in a proper bed for an hour, and then I'll get going and I won't stop to the finish. Yeah, that went well out the window because I end up in an oasis and I literally got completely, cannot be arsed with this shit. So I went and got like 2 hours down, had 2 hours down. And then a little bit later on, I was on a climb and I started to hallucinate. And so I smashed some caffeine, and caffeine takes about 20 minutes to kick in. Mm-hmm. So I just got off my bike, lay down, set an alarm for 20 minutes and dozed until the alarm went off, knowing that the caffeine kicked in, and then started riding again, just trying to stop that issue.
I guess that's one of the things for you as well, though, is with all your experience that you've got from all the other stuff you've done, that decision making, knowing, right, I know when I'm tired, I know what happens, so I'm going to manage that. Just that decision making process of I'm hallucinating, but recognizing you're doing it, recognizing stop, remembering it takes 20 minutes, I'll break, and all the rest of it. That's really good decision making to keep going when your body is so screwed up, and you're that affects your mental processes as well. So that, you know, a lot of that must have carried you through for what you've done.
Yeah, but when you think the bloke that won it barely slept, so I'm kind of weak in that sense that I need a lot more. Some people need less sleep than other people, don't they, at the end of the day? And I think a bit like how being dehydrated saps so much more energy and performance than you don't realize. I think, again, I got quite badly sunburned through losing my sun cream, that was probably sapping a lot of energy as well, because obviously you've got that. So there's a number of things that probably affected my performance. That's not an excuse, because that's part of it. It's like I say, when I did my record attempt, having issues, mechanicals, whatever it might be, and being resilient and be able to adapt and overcome and deal with that, that's part of it. The second you start riding your bike over 10 mile TT, where a punch is game over and you're not going to finish the race because there's no point, when you start going to 24 hours, 12 hours, these are races, your ability to bounce back from that stuff or not let it happen because you've planned ahead or you've been sensible enough to go, sun cream is a big deal. If I've not got sun cream, even though leg warmers will make me hot, I should wear leg warmers, which I didn't do. Do you know what I mean? There's loads of stuff like that I think is an experience-based thing, and that's where the difference comes from those people that have done it before and those that haven't. And and understanding that and appreciating that and going, right, how would I do things differently in future is what makes a big difference. And recognising that, from the off, I knew I wasn't an expert at it and I needed to gain that experience. So being receptive to it and listening to other people. So when you're riding alongside and you're chatting to these people that have been doing loads of these races, and you ask them, I've done Silk Road Mountain Race. So how do you find it? Was this harder or easier than that? Well, Silk Road's much harder. Yeah. You think, well, okay, I need to man up then. But yeah, so if they've gone, this is the hardest race of all time, you'd always go, well, maybe I can't finish it.
It sounds like it was a fantastic adventure during it. You've made, really interesting connections with both the locals as well as other people that are part of the race. You've had to bounce back. You've seen some fantastic things. You've interacted with wildlife and all the rest of it. How did it feel when you got to the line? What was it like there as a group?
That's the really interesting thing. So the first night I got my head down, I was a little bit nervous because after the 12 hour and the 24 hour, literally needed to be carried off my bike. Couldn't get off my bike myself. So I was worried that I'd end up in that situation on day one. It didn't happen. It happened day two, even though I had the saddle sores, actually my muscles were fine. Pinging. Well, I didn't have any problem with thinking my legs feel tired at any point. I could quite happy with them. There was plenty of go in them. Got to the end of the race, got off my bike, and was like, I need to see a doctor now. And then I just literally, I couldn't think straight. And I was like, I can't process the order I want to do the things I need to do next. And you could fit, and then I was getting almost like chaperoned by the absolutely fantastic checkpoint girl, the woman on the checkpoint, and a couple of the others that were there sort of helping.
And I was like, I was consciously aware that I was like fuzzy headed, not fuzzy headed in the sense like drunk, but just as in just like, I can't get my thoughts in order. And then everything started to feel like it was seizing. I was like, this is what it feels like at the end of a 24 hour. I don't feel too great now. And then I was like, oh, I can't feel my feet. I didn't realize I couldn't feel my feet. And oh, my rib really hurts. I don't remember doing that. Oh, actually, that was in that crash. And then and like it all started to come back. I was like, oh, do you know what? It's saddle sores are even hurting to walk now. Never mind, like ride my bike.
Isn't that amazing?
And yeah, and it all just sort of, and then, yeah, I just wanted to sleep so badly, and I wanted to eat, and I wanted to go to the toilet.
So your body, like, until you hit that finish line, you managed to keep going. Your body is
my tongue had blistered up, and my lips were all like sloughing off, and I was vaguely aware that I got blisters on my tongue from earlier on in the race, but it just became like, I still now my tongue, I can't. It doesn't feel perfect. It's healed much better up. But I don't know what caused it. And I was like, oh, this is awful. So everything's falling apart.
It sounds like it's like, you know, you cross that line, there's like a
like my brain went, done.
Yeah.
Which was really weird. And yeah, very odd. And then then everyone was walking around like, have you seen that end scene of Black Hawk Down? You know, when he goes, when I get home and people ask me and I just don't say a goddamn word. You know that scene?
Yeah,
it was like that. I was just like, PTSD.
Wow.
Thousand mile stairs.
Yeah, but that's just fascinating. And how long did it take for you guys to all recover? I mean, I'm guessing everyone would have been in a similar state coming over the line, so everyone would have probably sort of filtered off or been sat staring.
I absolutely loved the end. So the end was the best bit for me. So because you've got no idea when you're going to finish, you kind of have to book your flights for the after party cutoff. So everyone is hanging around. And so you've got all these people having had that shared experience, and then they've got nothing to do, and they don't really want to do anything. So like me and Alex and some of the others were pottering downtown town to get like as much drugs as they would sell us, involving various convictions of, trust me, this controlled drug is fine to give us to us. We want these things, and they're trying to give us like herbal remedies, but no, I want the following list of drugs, please. Try and sort ourselves out. And then just sitting around teaching people to play card games from work. So like, there's a particular card game that I play at work. When I say play at work, it makes it sound like we play it instead of doing work.
Yeah, we didn't reveal you're actually a professional poker player.
Yeah. But like, there are certain times when you've got like lunch break in certain scenarios where it's a particular game called Contract. And so basically taught them all to play Contract. And so there's quite a few people playing this card game for like hours and I'm like, I'm really sorry, it's a really long card game. It's for when you're waiting for something to happen. It's really good. And then I was like, no, it's fine. I've got nothing else to do today.
It's a new national sport in Morocco.
Yeah, I'm just going to drink mint tea and eat bread and honey. And like you say,
that's actually really good, because quite often if people get involved with these kind of big sort of events, you have that shared experience, and then everyone's gone.
Yeah, yeah. So
everyone's gone. And
it was really sociable.
To spend with each other, chat to people.
And I realised I hadn't got enough clothes for the amount of days that I had kicking around. So I went down to the shops. I was politely mocked by everyone that was at the site, because I decided I'd get something that allowed me to air myself. So I bought a Jabali.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, so I was basically cutting around in full Moroccan outfit.
Did you get a fez?
No. I didn't need a fez, did I? It was just the airing. So there I am sitting around in like this blue Jabali. Yeah. And
Why did you not just pull your pants down?
I don't think it's socially acceptable.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Not even in the UK? No.
So there I was, yeah. It didn't draw any attention to me whatsoever. The only person cutting about in basically a large what's the thing that Homer wears?
Like, Homer?
Yeah, Homer in The Simpsons. He has that big...
Oh, I thought you meant the
fat guy.
I thought
the fat guy dress thing. That's what it looked like.
Fat guy dressing Homer?
Oh, it's going to annoy me. What's it called? It's like a...
Caftan?
No. Well, that's basically what it is.
I wanted one.
I've got one at home. It cost me a whole £7.50.
And what did you do with all your racing kit? Did it just get chucked?
No, so I was going to just bin it. And I was like, actually, I don't know if I'm getting more team kit till... for a while, so I couldn't, in case I needed to race in team kit.
Because we've got a team launch coming up, and I don't know whether I'll need something to wear for that.
I can imagine the first person who tries to draft you is just going to be, what is awful that lot smell?
Of, awful lot of Vanish has got the white Arctic kit, a sort of dirty brown colour. But nice. Yeah, it's still there, so I've got it. I've got my kit. The shorts, we had a falling out. With my, me and my shorts, so I sacrificially burnt them. They will never be involved in my cycling ever again.
Oh, that is brilliant! Yeah. Your bib shorts were so bad you had to burn them.
Yeah, that's clinical waste. Yeah.
Oh wow! Well, look, so you've had this great experience. You've had the. It's so immense in terms of the impact on a human being going through all that. You then get the time to actually kind of decompress and with people who've been through that shared experience.
Oh, and they were all awesome. Fantastic. There was absolutely no one there that you thought, what a throbber, which is the worry, because if you can't work out who that person is, it's probably you.
But with a like-minded group like that, I mean, just talking to you, hearing you and Neil's chat, the night before you started, you could tell there was already a sense of, look, we're racing, but we're kind of, you know, this is too dangerous to be like squishing the other person and pushing them away to win. You've got to look out for each other to a certain degree. Have that time with them afterwards as well. That's fantastic. And so next year, is it going to be the Silk Road?
Well, so it's not like you can't guarantee entries into these races. So you kind of have to, they're a bit Ballot-esque. So hopefully, my plan is to enter one of the two of them, hopefully get into one of the two of them, alongside whatever other plans I have for next season, which will be very dependent on this season. So
yeah.
But there's like, these are the two Nelson events, right? But then there's also like
similar ones. So there's a couple of others that sort of people have chirped up and during the course, though, because it's, one of the things I found a struggle, it's a bit like anything, until you move in that circle, you're knowing which ones are. So it's quite hard to tell what's a race and what's a challenge or the bikepacking equivalent of a sportif fauna bird. And I'm not taking anything away from those, but I'm only really interested in doing the race aspect of the races, because I think for me, I want to race them, because the added benefit of racing them is if that all falls apart, you still get to complete them. Whereas if it's just completing them, it's an awful lot of money, an awful lot of effort, something I could do under my own steam and just enjoy it at a nice pace. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And soak it in as cycle touring.
Rather it's good than, to be there with the purpose as well.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. And a sense of achievement. So for me, I want to own the races. And from talking to the various different people, there's the obvious ones like the Transcontinental Race and stuff like that everyone knows about. But the ones that sort of cropped up during chatting to people is Italy Divide. Which is apparently very good.
Which divide? America.
Italy.
Oh, because, Italy. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. John Lloyd has done it, right?
I don't know.
I think he's done it.
But I know that, so it's James Hayden and Sophie, they came joint first last year in that race. Oh, nice. And then the other one, that ride around Rwanda looks kind of interesting, yeah. But I'm not entirely sure at the moment. But yeah, so there are a few other ones, but like I said, I really liked the outlook of the organizer and the fact he'd got his whole family involved, and that they're quite interesting characters. And I think there's an element of you kind of feel invested a little bit. It's a bit like your local bike shop. So with Mark at Lavello, I sense of, well, do you know what, because they're likable and because it's you sort of, there's a loyalty towards it. So having had such a lovely experience and feel so sort of engaged by it, it makes me want to go, okay, well, I'll race these other races.
Achieving this is not something you do just by yourself going out there. I know you've had support. So have you got any people or suppliers that you want to thank for supporting your adventure?
Yeah, so, I mean, you want to thank people for giving you a hand, but, I mean, genuinely, so, like, Madison were great because they just threw, like, mountain bike kit that I didn't have at me. And there's a mandatory kit list, so I had to take a first aid kit, had to take a waterproof and various other bits and pieces and gloves. And I kind of looked at the first aid kit, I was like, I just need to grab something light and small, because realistically, you can't carry the size of first aid kit that I think you'd need if you needed something out there. So just pay lip service to it. Yeah, and this first aid kit actually had a surprisingly large amount of stuff in it that I needed. I basically went through the whole lot of this first aid kit, and it was by Life Systems, which is Madison supplied it. Absolutely fantastic. And genuinely, it was like a tiny little thing, and you could fit it in all your kit. Genuinely worth recommending. Alongside the best rucksack on the history of the planet of all rucksacks ever, this Life Venture bag is like a waterproof dry bag, and it like fits in your pocket for if you need a bag. So I brought it in case I need to take extra supplies and stuff. But I had various issues with my frame bag, the zip going and stuff. So I had to then decant everything into that. And then I lost all my water bottles. So I ended up having to carry all these like normal traditional 1.5 liter. So I ended up with this rucksack on, which is like proper thin. And you would not think it would survive being fallen on top of, because I can't stay on a bicycle when riding off road without falling off at least once or twice a day. But I was like full on landing on it. And this thing is absolutely bombproof. And it's now my most favorite treasured rucksack of all time. And it will, I reckon it will survive the apocalypse.
The coronavirus.
No, it won't survive that. Nothing will. Those genuinely, like as much as like, you like the whole like, you know, like Forrest Gump with the ping pong bat.
Yeah.
So like genuinely, surprisingly good bits of kit that I wouldn't have thought they were. Yeah. But then they also gave me this really good duvet jacket, like an Isola jacket. And it was quite warm during the night, except suddenly it'd get cold about 3-4 in the morning till about 7 in the morning. And it was great to just put that on and just ride with that on. And then and that's all I really needed in terms of warm kit. So yeah, there's some really good bits of kit, and obviously the in terms of the bike, Celestial, absolutely amazing. They basically built that bike for that race.
Yeah,
massively better than the rider. You know, long stretch. I think someone else could have done a lot more with it. And when you looked, it was really interesting because Christian Meyer, the bloke that scratched the Pro Continental rider. If you look at his bike, and you look at the one that Celestial made, they're almost the same. But neither of them were copying each other, if that makes sense. They were made independently. It was only when everyone sent in their rigs of their bikepacking rigs that the what they both thought the requirement was.
Yeah,
they both were very, very similar.
And I have to say, it's a really cool bike. I mean, I quite like mechanical kit and all that kind of stuff. And I'd encourage anybody who's in the local area, pop to Lavello, because the bike's currently in the front window. Just pop down and have a look at it.
And speak to Mark Harris about it, because he knows everything there is to know about it. And he's he's the sort of the Lavello man. But like everything about like why things were chosen, like the bottom bracket specification is apparently really special. I mean, it's I want to say 47 or 74, or I'm going to make up a number. But basically, it's like an oversized threaded bottom bracket, like a traditional BSA one, but it's bigger, so it can accommodate all the different cranks. And he's like, well, that's the future, but people just don't realize it yet, because none of this press fit nonsense. You can take the bigger spindles and stuff, and the Lauf fork, and this, and then the rear seat stays, everything about it, the geo, everything. Yeah. It's all really cleverly thought out and well thought out.
Also, it looks really sick. Like I put it on Reddit on the Bike Pond section, and I think it had like 800 upvotes or something, which is like really good.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about it is it's really hard to tell from just looking at it on a photo, but the wrap on it is really, really cool. So it's like got like almost like a galaxy kind of V type thing. But when you look at it on a photo, it just looks like it's dirty. But yeah, it's really, really cool. So that bike was awesome.
And what's happening to that frame and bike now it's finished?
So I don't know. I imagine it probably would be for sale, but I think that it's more so you can see what can be made, because they're custom made. So they make all manner of different kind of bikes. So if you have a specification, they can make it. And the wheels on it, those Halo wheels, so despite me having 5 spokes less, the bike's wheels were solid because they were like over-engineered. So for an out-the-box wheel set, so normally I'd always say like get hand-built. We had a last-minute change because they had hand-built MV wheels on it. We suddenly realised that actually this, you couldn't get to spoke nipples, and I'm not, mechanically gifted enough to have been able to do anything with them. So we changed to Halo Vapors, and they absolutely were fantastic, because for a wheel to get absolutely destroyed like that because of my poor riding and then still be rideable just kind of goes how tough they were. So yeah, it's a really, really good package, that bike. But yeah, go have a look at it. And if you're in the market for a custom bike for a custom purpose, whether it's just a one bike to rule them all, or just a posh steel bike, they'll make it to order.
Yeah, lovely.
Probably for more money than I have, but... still. But custom bikes.
I think it's just really interesting just to go down and see a bike like that and be able to say that was built specifically for this event for one guy, and that these guys like have got that skill.
It's like,
skill
the, yeah,
to
it's
make
like the bicycle
it.
Version of a Paris Dakar. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, it's just pretty cool.
I'd say to everybody, you're not going to go out riding and ride past somebody on one of them. It's not going to be a regular thing. So, but it's a really interesting thing. We'll see if we can get some photos of it, I guess, on the website.
I have it on the website, but obviously in real life, it looks much better. So that's cool. Popped onto Lovelo.
Yeah.
In the window.
Brilliant. Well, look, I mean, that's you've had a, it sounds like you've not just had sponsors that have helped. They've actually provided really, really good kit.
I mean, it comes back to like you sort of supporting your local bikes from local businesses. I mean, Celestial's quite a local business. So, but yeah, it is great.
Great. That's cool. Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming back in and giving us the tale of what happened with the Atlas Mountain.
Everyone's going to get fed up with me in that I think I'm like the most mentioned person. Then I did a podcast, then I did like three.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay. We're actually going to change it now to the Nicocino podcast. But no, it's been brilliant having you come in, because I think what's great for people who are listeners, they've heard bits of the story, stuff that you've done before, the night before, and now hearing about the story of the race itself. And I think for...
The journey of an amateur bike packer. How not to do it, step one.
Well, I think what we try to do to give for people is we try to give them a bit of entertainment. We try to give them a bit of education in different stuff that's going on. But mostly we try to give people a bit of inspiration. I don't think anyone can listen to the stuff that you're doing without being... inspired, even if it's as inspired as Neil's to go out immediately and order a whole load of bike packing kit as well.
They will never use. That's great.
Who knows?
Are you going to use it in the Silk Road Mountain Race? or the Atlas one?
Let's start slow. Maybe I start with the race rock.
You don't have to go fast. You can start slow. That's the that's the tip top tip of that kind of race.
I would think about it.
I still love the idea of just taking a tarp, riding to a pub, and then using a tarp over a pub table, and then you can sleep underneath it. That's kind of
just get a bivy bag.
You can do that.
You can buy really cheap.
But no,
bivy
but
bags.
Now you see, yeah, bivy bag I could do, but you see, this my route means I have to find a pub, and I have to sleep in the back garden.
Yeah,
window
by King Queens.
yeah, we'll do it. Next King Queens.
So yeah, Nick, thank you so much for coming. It's fantastic. Always refreshing talking to you. And if you out there have any questions to Nick that we haven't asked yet, or that Nick hasn't answered by himself without us asking him, send an email to podcast@villacino.com. We will pass on the question and can answer it for you in the next podcast with whoever that will be.
Indeed. And if you would like to follow Nick, I believe it's Nick Icarus, isn't it?
It's insert correct it's Instagram and Twitter handle here.
Oh, I actually know.
It's just... Underscore Nicarus. That's the Instagram. Yeah. But in terms of for the race, hashtag Atlas Mountain Race gets you the best photos. Yeah. And then from that, you can see all the everyone else's content, the fantastic photos by all the different people that have smashed themselves to pieces to do that race.
Yeah, we will also put in the description of this podcast or like in the Instagram post, we will put all the names of some of the others in there that you can follow. And you should follow. The pictures are amazing. And yeah, and if you want to support us, we would be grateful for every review you would leave on Apple iTunes or Apple Podcasts, how it's called now. And
or Spotify.
Yeah.
Or whatever podcast app you use.
Exactly. Like follow us, subscribe, and yeah. And like. Tell your friends about us.
And people you don't like.
And your mum.
Yeah.
And send us any ideas you've got for episodes, stuff you like, stuff you don't like. That'd be great. But mostly tell as many people about us as possible. That was it then for our episode, our third episode with Nicarus. And just to say, thanks again, Nick. It's been lovely to have you in here. And remember, everybody, you don't have to ride quite as far as Nick has. You don't have to have quite as much adventure of that packed in every time you go out and ride your bike. But make sure, even though it's dark and even though it's wet, this time of year, get out on your bike, because still the best stories have not yet been written.